You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Two of Honoring Hazel with Shayna, Tates, and Ashley. We get to have the honest conversation about we're creating future addicts in this system. Because we're traumatizing children and we're putting them through the system. Like you said, they're not able to regulate and understand, oh, mom and dad didn't show up because mom and dad are struggling or mom and dad aren't. They see it as a failure to them. I'm not enough. Mm-hmm. I'm not good enough. Nobody loves me. I'm not enough for this drug. The drug wins. And honestly, that's when you talk to addicts, and people struggling with addiction, they don't want the drug to win. They don't want that life. Most of them don't want that life, but the drug is winning. And they can acknowledge that, but a child can't understand that. So in the broken system that we have right now, we're just creating more broken children that them themselves can either, they're either left with the immense work of breaking the cycle, which is a lot to put on somebody. a lot to put on a human being is they have to make that decision to break the cycle or fall into the pattern, the blueprint that they were given at birth. So how do we help those kids? And that starts with our littles all the way up to our teens. It doesn't matter what point that the state interferes into your life. Once the state is in there, we're creating trauma. So how do we cushion that trauma? And I know for me, the group homes, not all group homes. I'm not gonna advocate for group homes out the gate because it is very particular. We have group homes that are very dangerous, very much the problem, mm-hmm. not being regulated, causing, you know, a lot of children deaths too, that we need to look at. But how do we get these kids the help they need before they become a statistic? And are we focused on making sure that they're not a statistic in the system?
That's why I feel like the goal needs to be changed completely. If we keep having the goal of reunification and that being the number one goal, no matter what, I'm not saying I don't agree with reunification, but if that keeps being the goal, it's never going to change. The goal needs to switch to the children's safety, no matter what that is, whether that's being with their parents or being with a foster parent or whatever that is. And until that number one goal changes, it's not going to change because that's the main focus is the reunification and not the child's safety, which it should be. No matter if they're babies, no matter if they're littles or they're teenagers, it needs to always be the child's safety, not the reunification at first.
1,000%. And if we, and you can take it even further back. So another rule that they've recently rolled out in Washington state is that, you know, we've got this HB 1227, the Keeping Families Together Act. So that's focused on reunification. And when Ashley was talking about the lockbox, that means they told families, basically, you can be a drug addict. You can do drugs in your house while you have your children, you and your like significant other or your husband, wife, whatever. You just have to be on a drug schedule. You can do drugs from 9 to 11. I'll do drugs from 11 to 1. What drug addict is actually going to follow that drugs? Now your kids are seeing drugs because we've told them it's okay to do drugs in front of your children. That's ridiculous. If you ask any law enforcement what they think of that, I mean, what is their answer going to be to you? I mean, that is not okay to do in front of children. But let's roll it back even further. There's another rule that's come out in Washington. Now, babies who are born to mothers who have substance abuse orders and who are exposed to substances at birth, now hospitals are not required to report that to DCYF. They're just allowed to go home with their mother with not a resource in the world. I don't know what everyone knows about babies that are born addicted to drugs, but those babies are not easy babies. They cry, they're fussy, they have all sorts of possible cognitive issues because of that, that make them very difficult, and they need extra care. But now we're not requiring those doctors or nurses, we're actually not even allowing those doctors or nurses to call DCYF. So now those mothers who decided during pregnancy that they were going to use drugs, that it was more important to use drugs than to stop using while they were having a baby. They didn't want to, you know, take advantage of services if they were offered. I don't know if they were offered. But now we're not going to offer them any services. I mean, that's from day one, from that little infant. We are not supporting that child and their trauma or supporting that mother. Because how is that mother or that father going to go home addicted to drugs with a newborn that has a substance abuse issue? I mean, that is just mind-blowing to me that is not a red flag to the safety of that baby. Because, I mean, I took my own babies home from the hospital not drug addicted, and that was hard enough. As somebody who was of sound mind and of body, I can't imagine if you were addicted to drugs and had an addicted baby, and then you're not offered any services. We're just sending them home because we didn't have to call DCYF.
And let's talk about the realistic that we're not always sound mind and sound body, even when we're not on drugs, when we bring our babies home. Because
absolutely,
we have, our hormones have changed.
Yeah.
This is a new human. This is a whole new experience. So like you said, the struggle alone. And we don't talk enough about the brain chemistry that women already go through, and the baby blues and how serious those can be. And then you straddle addiction or having to worry about housing or having to worry about them feeding themselves when they get home. So like you said, rolling it back when they're coming in to deliver these babies, we literally just say, hey, human, here's another little human. Goodbye. Thanks for your insurance payment. Have a great day. You were here for 2 days. Now take this brand new, you know, sweetness home and you'll be fine. Like, we don't give any basic resources. So you're right at the point when we say this person's struggling with addiction because this is what this blood test tells us. This is what a blood test, again, can't tell us everything we know about a person, but okay, this blood test tells us that they're struggling with addiction. I can understand saying, you know what, let's not freak them out. Maybe there's a better approach, but we're saying we have no approach. Now we're just saying, in Washington, we're saying, we're going to pretend like we didn't see this. We're going to give you this baby. Is it at least marked on medical records for a future?
I'm not exactly sure. The article that I read was from the Seattle Times, and it's from last summer. So you can Google it. But the article talked about how now that those babies were normally cared for in like a specialized nursery, that they no longer take those babies to the specialized nursery. Those babies will go in the room with the mother from the instant, unless there was like a medical issue with like they can't breathe or, you know, something like that. So where that child would have been monitored from the get-go because of addiction issues, because the baby is now detoxing, that baby goes in the room with the mother from the get-go, and then there is not a call to DCYF made. So, that baby is literally set up for failure from day one. And when we're talking about, are we setting up someone else for a life of drug addiction and trauma? I mean, what are we doing to those little newborns? I mean, and maybe that's the turning point for a mother, right? Maybe like the baby's here, but if we're not going to be able to offer them services, like by getting someone there, and you know, maybe that's a wake up call when CPS shows up and is like, hey, like, what's going on here? We need to get you some help. But if we're not even going to offer that anymore, like, what are we doing? And part of it feels like, is this just a way to shrink their numbers to show that they're not involved in as many cases? Because when you listen to Ross Hunter, the secretary of DCYF, All he wants to talk about is how they have so fewer numbers this year. Well, you have so fewer numbers because you're not taking cases, and you're not taking cases because of HB 1227. You're not taking cases because hospitals are alerting CPS and DCYF when babies are born with substance abuse. It's not that you're making progress in Washington State and your outreach to people is working. It's that you're not protecting these vulnerable children. And that is what we're yelling about. And we're trying to make them see that you're doing that on the backs of dead children. And that's what's really, really scary, because those children don't have any hope. And I don't know how you can sit in a position like that and not feel like you have, and I hate to say this term, but like blood on your hands in that sense. Like, I couldn't live with myself if there were kids dying on my watch and not be doing something to change that.
That goes back to what Ashley was saying. What's his relevance in that situation other than you being mm-hmm. a legislator? And not to say that our legislators don't take time to educate themselves and don't go out in our communities and speak to each other. I mean, I personally think they don't enough, but I'm not calling out every legislator and saying that they're not. But you're coming to the table with no actual experience, and you're making laws on no actual experience. And they're not listening to the nurses that are in that situation. They're not listening to the foster care parents. They're not listening to the social workers who were overworked. I know how many times my name was just a file. Like, it was just a file on a desk, and then someone would show up and I'd meet them and I'm like, you're not my guardian ad litem. You're not my social worker. Who are you? Oh, you're just new. You're assigned. And they're off to the next person. They spend 5 minutes with me. They know nothing about me, but now they're going to go represent me in court and the things that I need. I mean, we're failing these kids, and I knew we were failing them back then, but throughout this time, it seems like it comes down to, for legislators, money. Like, honestly, it really feels like it does, because like you said, if we can not make reports, then we look like we're shrinking numbers, which means we can take more money from that bank that we had put aside to help these children that need help. Because look at these numbers, look at these statistics, they need help, we need to put money in that. But if we change the statistics, then we can take the money from the already struggling system that was already on its knees begging for help, and make it, instead of fixing the problem, just make it look statistically better on paper.
Exactly. And that's just like you guys said, that's what creates the vicious cycle. It's literally every, you know, 14, 15 years or however long, you know, it's these children are having children, and it starts all over again, and it will forever until it's fixed.
Right. Because it is messed up to leave on that child coming out of the system that drops you when you're 18. I know that we've like further have these systems now where they say, okay, we're going to help till you're 21 or 22. But I had friends that actually stayed in that system, and that system doesn't play nice either. That system looks at you and continues to control your life. And as a child who was in a system who had no control and no voice, turning 18, the last thing you want to do is roll with the system that failed you for the next 4 years of your life. So you either have to roll with the system that was never there for you, that has all these regulations on your life that make you feel like you can't breathe, or you can say, I'm going to try it myself. And we all know how scary the world is right now and how hard it is to make it. I have a niece that works 2 jobs, and she's like, Auntie, I don't think I'll ever be able to afford a car to my own place. Like, this world is really hard right now, and we're taking these kids that we shoved through a broken system, and we're like, okay, good luck.
Yeah. And like you said, a lot of it has to do with the money and making it look like it's bringing down numbers and all of that. And they're taking from an already broken system. And it's because they don't have a solid foundation. They literally created this foundation that they have, and they're finding out that, you know, that it's not working that well, but they're just stacking more on top of it. And so the bottom is just crumbling to pieces, and they just keep stacking more because they don't want to actually get to the root of the problem and fix the foundation. And until they're able to get to the root of the problem and fix the foundation, we're just going to keep having that same trickle crumbling effect, putting the kids in jeopardy. And, you know, and it's, yeah.
And the last thing you'd want to be in this day and age is a social worker, because the social worker is limited. I mean, we look at these cases like Ariel Sellers. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that case out of Hawaii. She was placed with foster care, and in foster care is her foster parents murdered her, allegedly, I have to say, allegedly, because they're still in trial. And it's actually changing a lot of the way that people are looking at Hawaii CPS, and they're getting sued by a lot of people now that say that those records should always be unsealed and available, especially if there's one issue. If we have one issue against a social worker, or we're feeling like something's not being done, CPS files need to be unsealed, and we need to see what was done, how it was done, and who handled it. But we need, and we villainize social workers a lot in that situation, but I know social workers that will tell me, I have 500 files. What do you want me to do with 500 files? Because they're not putting the money in to hire more of us. They're not, and because we villainize them so much, people aren't wanting to walk into those shoes and help people. And I do think there are times, I know I had social workers that I'm like, why are you even here? Like, you don't care about kids. You don't care about this situation. This is literally a paycheck to you. And that's something I wanted to know from doing this job. I know I get very emotionally invested in children and that situation. So as a social worker or someone in that system, at what point of a line of a relationship should we have with those children? Because you're going to fight harder for a child that you can actually, that you get to know, that you care about, but it can also blind you when you deeply care. So how do you ladies handle that?
That's kind of hard. It really is. Like I said, like, I don't do social work for DCYF. I do in-home services, and I did visit supervision, and that was really hard, because I think really it just comes down to like keeping those professional boundaries and being able to have compassion and empathy, but also being able to disconnect when you need to, if that makes sense, so that you're not taking it on. Like, you're putting yourself in the situation and you're having that empathy, but you're not taking that all on yourself. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
And it's really hard. Like, there has been many times where I've been in my car and I've bawled my eyes out because I just feel like I didn't do enough, or I feel like I wasn't able to be there as much as I wanted to for the kid because I was so focused on the parent. That's the other thing that I wish that we could figure out is CASAs are supposed to be there for the child and what's best of the child and the safety of the child. And you have these parents who are getting these resources of like FPS workers, triple P workers, behavioral, all of these things that these parents are able to access. But what about the children? What about the children? They need mentors. They need voices. They need, you know, and I don't feel like they focus on that very much. And I feel like that's so important. Like, I remember going through what I went through when I was younger. I had a big buddy in my school, and it was just somebody that was specifically there for me to take me away from all of my stuff that I had going on in my head, whether that was just playing basketball for a little bit, or playing board games, or doing arts and crafts, or just something that took me away from everything. And I was able to talk to them about my feelings. So I think that that's something that they also need to work on, is not just having these services for the parents and the family. Like, I think that they really need to have a specific person that is more of a life mentor for the children, for the child. Starting, it's kind of hard with the younger ones, you know, but starting when they get into school age, like being able to just have that person that they know is their safe person.
Right. Well, and it seems like the only way that we get kids help, and this goes from kids in homes that just need help that come through the system, kids in school that need help, runaway kids. The only way that we get these kids help is through the judicial system. So it's like they have to get in trouble, or the parent has to get in trouble. There has to be almost a legal consequence to get the kids in the system. So we need a system where we can bring them in without it being a punishable act on the children. Yes. Because we all we're doing in this system is punishing the kids continuously over and over and over again. Because even with this goal of reunification, when they do go, let's say they go back and then it doesn't work and they get pulled out of the home again, now they come to another foster family. I've had people tell me that I worked with a case where her mom was an addict and they were going in and out. And she said, I would get removed and I'd be put back with my mom. Things would be great. And then mom would fail again. And we knew it was coming to the point that we started running away because we didn't want to be taken from our mom one more time where we were hiding. Because it started being that we were placed in foster care and we missed our moms and we would cry and we would go through all these things. And then we were labeled troubled kids to the point where the social worker would introduce them as trouble one and trouble two, and you're going to have problems. What fair start is that for a child? Like, they're not even, they wouldn't even acknowledge that they were losing their mother again and how hard this was on the kid, and they were losing their home again. They were just introduced as trouble one and trouble two and watch them, they're runners. And now that's how they were treated by the father. Like, oh, these are problem children. These are a problem. They have behavioral issues. And it's not a behavioral issue thing. It's a needs therapy thing. It's a, like you said, needs a consistent thing. And if they did have a consistent buddy through all that, like, oh, this is happening again, but I'm going to see Sam. I know that Sam's going to be there when I get pulled out. We could help. We could help with that consistency. And we don't have, like you said, we don't have a consistent social worker. We don't have anything consistent. Why, when a social worker is assigned, why are they ever removed? Why are we ever moving them when there isn't a problem with the family approaching it or the foster family approaching it? Why are they being reassigned in this cycle instead of when you hit the system, this is your worker? And this is who's going to work with your parents, and who works with your parents talks to your social worker. Why are we having these gaps, and why are we having these issues?
As you know, Erin, you and Ashley, both of you, I think it's probably safe to say that both of you are cycle breakers. You know, both of you have been through a lot, and I mean, you're here today. Both of you are here making a difference. Do you think that for, you know, other kids, I mean, like you just said, other kids who've been through all the things that you've been through in and out of the system, do you think having that one mentor, that one person can help break the cycle for other kids?
Absolutely. It's so lonely because you're going so many different places and you're going through so much, and whatever you're going through, and no matter what child what they're going through, when your parent is removed for whatever reason they're removed, or you're removed from the home for whatever reason you're removed, your life is shattered into a million pieces because now your school might change, your friends might change, you might get taken to a different state, you might not know where you're going for a few days, and you meet so many different people. It's like, oh, hi, my name's this, and I'm going to help you. And the next week, hi, my name's this, I'm going to help you. I absolutely think if you had someone consistently through that, we would have done a lot less therapy. I would have paid for a lot less therapy, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I feel like CPS owes me for all my therapy, to be honest. I feel like they should be paying for it, but that's just a personal preference. But yeah, absolutely. I don't know for you, Ashley, if you had someone that was consistent. I mean, I felt like we held on to anything that was consistent.
Yeah, I was probably in foster for, I don't know, I wish I could get my record so I could actually look, but I think I was in there for about 10 months. And I would definitely say yes, if I had somebody that was, you know, and we have peer mentors, which are, you actually have to fill out, you know, an application. There has to be some kind of experience or background that you've went through, whether that's with mental health, substance abuse, homelessness. I've went through those. So to be able to have somebody that kind of has been through or experienced things and have them be yours, specifically your contact, your person of contact, and be consistent in your life through all of that, definitely, definitely. I would have loved to have that because, like you said, you feel so alone and like nobody understands you. Nobody knows where you're coming from. But if you had that one person that was yours, not your parents, not part of the systems, but yours to be able to safely rely on kind of and just be your person, I definitely think it would have. I think I would have, like you said, I would have not had to go through so much therapy. I think I would have been able to move through my trauma a lot faster, you know, and just, yeah, I agree. I agree with you. And Tate's, yeah, the answer is yes.
And like you said, you know, like you literally said the same thing that I say sometimes where I'm like, I need the files, because trauma messes with your mind. Like, and that's the thing too, I don't think that people understand, when these little kids all the way to high school, you know, 18, aging out, you're asking us what the problem is, but there's things that we can't put words to. There will be things that children experience that they will not have the words to put to, because they don't understand.
Hey! Oh, my dog is going crazy. I'm sorry. Cooper! Go through trauma like that also. Like, I really disassociated from a lot of my trauma and just tried to just blank it out. Like, there's stuff that I honestly can sit here and try to remember, and I can't remember, because I've just blanked that part out. And when you go through your healing journey, you know, like, I've been really working on mine since Hazel, those things start to come up, and then you'll start to notice different triggers. And then you're having to face those triggers, and you're like, man, I thought I dealt with that like a long time ago. Why is this resurfacing now? So that's kind of when a little bit of my memory and stuff started coming back of different things and different incidents. But yeah, I think when you're going through that trauma, a lot of times you just disassociate and you don't even want to remember that kind of stuff.
And so they don't know how to ask for help. I think that's a big part, is like, they don't know, you know, there's times where they sit down and they're like, well, what's going on at home? And the kid doesn't know how to put it to words. So they go, oh, nothing's going on at home. We can send them back. They'll be fine. Like, things will be okay. And we shouldn't be relying on these children to be the dictators to explain to you what's happening in the home, because kids, like you said, we disassociate, we don't understand, or
we also think it's normal.
Well, right. Sometimes. How do you know what's outside of your normal until you know, you're hanging out with those kids and you're talking about like your life at home? And like, I noticed as an adult, there'd be times where I'm like, oh, we didn't all go through that. Okay. Gonna just take that sad little story and tuck it away for later, because you don't realize, because it was your normal. And then you have everybody looking in the room like, you good? And you're like, no, you all didn't do this. And so a kid's not going to know that. When an adult didn't know that, I didn't know that into my 30s. There'd be times where I'm like, oh, I made the whole room awkward. Okay. And you know, so like you said, there's triggers. I pulled up the other day, I grew up around here, and I went around the back of the middle school, and I saw where the bus dropped off, and I was with my daughter, and I was like, whoo, like, you know, a whole flood of memories came back, and I was like, oh, those were hidden. Okay, gonna drive away. We're gonna like pack those back in a box, because, you know, I don't want to deal with these right now. We're gonna move on. But I'd forgotten about them for years until I saw that school drop off, and it just brought back so much. I mean, I feel like these kids, like, I was diagnosed with CTPSD because it's continuous situations. Like, these kids don't even have a minute to heal from the first one before it hits again. And so we don't know how to explain them. And I don't think the system, like you said, is built at all to handle these kids, that they want to look at it in a situation of, oh, this is just a drug problem, or this is just a home, a homeless problem, or this is just a lack of funds problem. But it's never that simple. It's never that simple in the home. Once CPS is walked in, they're not taking the time to realize that addiction comes from not just deciding one day to pick up and be addicted. Addiction comes from either their trauma as a child, their trauma as an adult, maybe the fact that they can't afford things and they're struggling and that eases their pain. Maybe they've lost someone. We don't even address those issues with the parent. And then we throw the kid in the system. So while we have resources for the parents, are we really addressing how we got there in the first place?
That's hard, because I think that sometimes, yes, but then again, it all comes down to the voluntary part, because we can offer them all these services, but if they don't want them, they're not going to take them. But the thing is if they don't want them, then in a sense, we're kind of putting that child's life in jeopardy too. And that's why I say I have such a hard time with the voluntary and involuntary, because Brandon, my brother, he got Hazel back and he didn't even finish like barely any of the stuff that he was supposed to finish. And she was actually probably going to be coming back to my mom and my stepdad in December. And she was murdered November 27th. So it's such a fine line, because I do believe that these parents need to do the work if they want their children. I do believe that if there are services that are offered to them, that if they really want to be able to make sure that their child is in a safe environment, they want to have their children in their home and all of that, I do feel that they need to take advantages of those services. And if they choose not to, then we're just putting that kid's life in their hands, for one. We're just putting that kid's life in an unsafe environment that we know about, but we're kind of giving the choice. But the thing is if they were grown, you know, would they want to be in that environment? Would you leave your own child in that environment? That's the thing I ask legislators all the time, is, or even like other people, like, would you let your own child be in that environment? Like, drugs are illegal for a reason. They're called illegal drugs. And we have the fentanyl epidemic. But the thing is that I'm trying to get legislators to understand is that, okay, if these parents aren't going to take these services, they're not going to take the help, then you're leaving these kids in unpredictable and unsafe environments. And the thing is that when it comes to fentanyl, now drug dealers and people are putting fentanyl in everything. They're putting it in weed. They're putting it in methamphetamines. They're putting it in crack, coke, whatever they can. More and more people addicted. And so, like, are you going to have a drug test to take in when you drug test, you know, these environments? Because when it comes to fentanyl, like, they breathe it in, it can actually overdose them. At one of the domestic violence shelters, when I worked at the domestic violence shelter, there was a woman upstairs and she had fentanyl and she had it in her room. And I went up there and me and another one were ending up cleaning it. And automatically we got lightheaded and felt sick and had to walk out of the room. Like, imagine if that was a child. So it's just so hard, because I think that if you want your child, if you have these addictions and you really want help and you really want to get clean and somebody is offering you these services, that you're going to take them to be able to keep, you know, your child. If you don't want them and you're not willing to take them, well, then, you know, then we're just leaving these kids in unsafe environments with unpredictability. So it's hard.
If you're not taking the services, isn't that just a voluntary, I don't want my kid? I mean, shouldn't it be? I mean, I don't want to be that harsh again and black and white about it, but if you have all these resources coming to you saying, hey, we can help. And if you're saying, I'm not willing to take the resources, aren't you in turn saying, I'm not willing to work for, isn't that obvious to the social workers, the legislators, that saying, I'm not willing to work for my kid?
That's how I feel. And it is. It's such a sticky, like you said, it's such a sticky subject. And like, I don't want to be a jerk or anything, but like, to me, that's how it would be. Okay, you're not willing to work for your child, then you shouldn't have your child.
Because, right. And we can come back when you are willing and reevaluate. I'm not saying like, but I mean, honestly, if you're saying I don't want to take the resources, that's saying I don't want to take the responsibility of raising this child safely.
Yes, I agree with you 100%, 100,000%. And that's kind of where I'm at. That's why the voluntary and the involuntary thing is so hard for me, mm-hmm. is because I'm exactly at that. If we're offering you, you know, all these different services, treatment, housing after treatment, like they have something here called PCAP workers that work with moms that are, you know, using substance abuse, and they help them from birth to, I think, I want to say 4 years old. You know, there's all these different services, and we're handing them to you on a platter, and you're saying, no, I don't want to take those. Then you're saying, no, I don't want to be a safe parent for my child. I don't want to do the work. And I'm sorry, parenting is not easy, and you have to do the work. You have to do the work. And if you're not willing to do the work, then you shouldn't have your child.
Absolutely.
And you're right. And this has been a problem in Washington State for years. Parents have been allowed to say, I don't want the treatment. I don't want the help. I don't want any extra treatment. And they shut the door in the social worker's face, and they are still allowed to keep the children. Why is this allowed? And to back up what you said about fentanyl is an epidemic in Washington State. We have talked to law enforcement officers that have told us, just like Ashley said, it is in every single type of drug there is now. It's cheap, it's easy to make, so it's in everything. So if they're now going to say that fentanyl is the only drug that can be what they're calling an imminent harm, then they better be ready to test every type of drug there is, because according to law enforcement, it's in everything. But they're not, you know, that the legislators haven't even thought that far ahead, because they don't talk to law enforcement officers. They're not talking to the doctors. They're not talking to the social workers who are living this. They live in this complete bubble. And I don't want to say all of them, because it's not all of them, but some of them live in this complete bubble where they read the statistics, or they talk to, you know, the head of this or the head of that. They're not talking to the people with the real lived experience. And, you know, I know, like, for us, when we have people come to us, that's what we try and we make sure to do. We like to talk to people who have, you know, been through this experience, talk to law enforcement, like, what is going on with fentanyl right now? And that's what they're telling us. It's in everything. You can't get away from it. You're picking, you know, they're not seeing heroin anymore. They see fentanyl. That's all they're picking up. You know, and like, someone's getting picked up for weed, there's fentanyl in it. You know, there's a new built blue pill on the street, it's fentanyl. So when are they going to make sure that that law, which says that, you know, fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, they're going to make sure that it's not in the marijuana. It's not in, you know, whatever they're cutting with it. But the thing is that they won't. They'll just pretend like that's not happening. And that is what is scary, is because some of these legislators just, like, live in this bubble that think that they can make a bill that, like, kind of covers it, but doesn't really. And then they'll throw some more money towards, substance abuse rehabilitation that parents don't have to take. And then we've covered it. We're protecting the kids. And we're not, because, you know, we're still seeing, like, kids dying. And it's just scary.
I want to just piggyback off what Shayna just said really quick, too, and how she talked about, like, you know, legislators and stuff living in a bubble. And part of that problem is, and we've experienced this ourselves, legislators not even having the education of what fentanyl even is. You know, that's part of the problem.
Definitely. I think there's a, I think it goes to, like you said, it's like a bubble. It's like you're so far removed. And I think it comes all the way down to therapy and social workers. And there, I was talking to somebody the other day about, at some point with therapy, like, you have to look at your therapist and realize that when they started, they came from a normal life. Every day they walked among all of us, right? And they shopped all among us, and they had the same issues that we did. And they were still, you know, they were having the same problems, but then they kind of financially climb that ladder and they get more academic. They kind of move away from, you know, the everyday life, because now they're surrounding themselves in a different community, around different people. So they're not walking the same, streets we are, with the same issues that we have. So then at some point their therapy becomes so academic that it doesn't relate to you anymore. Not that they don't know what they're talking about academically, great, but they can't personally interact with you. And I feel like our legislators and our social workers can sometimes, judges, they can all end up in that bubble. And how do we pop it and be like, come back to, like, the rest of us that are walking and living in this world and in this street? How do we do that beyond bringing our own bills? Because, like you said, you can bring the perfect bill, but they're going to change it to what benefits them the most. I mean, let's be honest. They don't look at their constituents as much anymore as they look at the people around them in their bubble and say, how is this going to affect you, me, and how do we best handle this bill and give them a little bit of what they want? So how do we pop that bubble? How do we get through? How do we get them to hear our pleas?
I think that, first of all, you have to have a relationship with somebody in legislation who is going to support you. You just can't go in willy-nilly, right? You have to have somebody. And I have to say, we do have legislators that are extremely supportive, will give honest feedback, which I also think you have to have somebody who is going to be honest with you. And responsive. And we do have that. We do have a legislator who takes the text messages, responds, is supportive, and who tells us that we're doing a good thing. So you do have to have that. That legislator also has experience with foster care. So I think that makes a difference, for sure. And you know, when Ashley has hosted the rallies, we've had legislators show up. That's huge. That's huge to have legislators show up to show their support. And I think it's little steps like that, that our beliefs and values align with some of the changes that they're hoping to see. Will it ever be perfect? Probably not. We'll probably never get what we want. But I think that we can sort of align the path so that we're getting some of what we want with what they're getting, what they want to, you know, hopefully create some sort of bill that saves these vulnerable children, protects them more. But it's gonna take work, and it's gonna take years of this type of work, and for us to keep pushing. Last year we had the spring before, we had the Oakley-Carlson Act, which was kind of our first jump into legislation. All of us, we all kind of showed up and tried to push that through, and it got to a hearing, which was great. But it never made it to a committee vote. And we were told that it never made it to a committee vote because of budgetary stuff, that they were never going to support it because it was too much money. And that's what we were told, basically because it was going to force families to be monitored for 5 years if you lost your children due to abuse or substance abuse. So you would be monitored for 5 years instead of the 6 months. Which, of course, families who had lost children really liked that, because, you know, we saw a pattern of, it was more than 6 months later that, you know, children were going back into foster care. You know, people relapsed after 6 months, and it was, you know, a pattern. But of course, you know, they didn't like that because it was going to cost them so much more money to, you know, have people monitored for 5 years. So do I think we'll ever get that? Absolutely not. But do I think that we could come up with some sort of deal where there's more monitoring for families to keep children safe? I think that that's a possibility. Do I think that we need to work with a legislator who's going to somehow guide us into what that could be? We need that. So what we have to do, we have to support those legislators. So Tates and I, the best we can, there's an oversight, DCYF oversight board meeting. It's typically every other month. It hasn't been that this year, but we show up to those because we know that it helps support the legislators who need some support. We show up to that because it's kind of like us doing our part to show our support, and, you know, in hopes that they hear us, they know we're there to support, and that kind of bridges those connections. So I think that's how you kind of get through to people. You just got to keep showing up. You got to keep sending the letters. You know, it's definitely a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I think like Ashley knocks on those doors. She has presentations, and it's not always easy to be in those meetings by yourself with 10 people who are questioning you. And sometimes those questions feel judgmental or almost like accusatory. And I don't think that they're ever meant to be. They're asking the hard questions because somebody's going to be asking the hard questions when it comes to laws and stuff like that, but you just have to keep showing up. I mean, eventually I feel like you do connect with the right people.
And I'll piggyback off what Shayna said. It is. It's all about showing up and not giving up and not taking no for an answer and finding the right legislators that are willing to listen to you, willing to work with you. Like I said, Shayna had introduced me to one specific legislator that I think is the one she's talking about. And then that ended up being me giving a presentation to, I think there was, I want to say eight legislators I gave a presentation to. And when she talks about the oversight also, that was something out of the Oakley-Carlson Act, the bill that I really stood behind, because 6 months is not enough time. And when, especially with parents who, you know, are suffering from addiction or have substance abuse or even domestic violence or mental health or anything in their past. So when I did my presentation, I really had to dive deep and like research and figure out why I felt that this certain amount of time was sufficient for oversight. And I came up with a year to 18 months. And how I got that is I looked into relapse. Like when people that are in substance abuse or certain things like that, when is their like biggest like relapse rates? And so I looked into that and I shared that with them. And because honestly, 5 years is a lot. It is a lot of oversight. It is also a lot for social workers to be able to, you know, expand like that. And we already have a shortage and a turnover rate that is insane. So I was trying to figure out kind of a common ground, but also have the research to back up why I felt that a year to 18 months was sufficient.
What do you think the average person, the person that stumbles across this video or wants to learn more about it, what can the average everyday person do to make a difference? I know it's a hard one because we're coming from a totally different lens, but just the average everyday person that doesn't have this experience, doesn't, you know, or, you know, maybe they've heard about it in their family. Because we talk a lot about how if it doesn't come to your doorstep, it's not your problem, right? Like, or you just aren't aware of it. Like, you have no, there are people that tell me all the time that find themselves in this missing, murdered, lost child foster care situation. They say their rose-colored glasses snapped. Just one day they snapped. And they didn't know this whole world existed around them. For those wearing the rose-colored glasses, how do they help?
Well, so the first thing I would say is that, sorry, I would say to follow us on social media, because not only do we focus on missing persons, we do focus on children who have been failed by Washington State. So we try to put out any articles about children failed by Washington State. In the month of April, we focus on specific stories of children failed by Washington State. When we have any events that are held at the Capitol or information, we put all of that out on our social media. So that's the first way that you could get involved. We also, on our lighttheway missing.com website, have a whole page dedicated to, it's called My Reason, and it's basically my reason for supporting child abuse prevention. And it has the many stories of children who've been failed by DCYF. So you can click on that section and go to the stories of these kids. There is Hazel's story, and we have a letter that Ashley wrote about Hazel that is quite touching. And we a lot of times will have call to actions. Our current call to action for everyone is to help us to get an outside independent investigation of Oakley Carlson's Washington DCYF case. We have a change.org petition. We just feel like Washington DCYF is not being held accountable for what happened in her missing persons case. They knew what was going on. They did nothing. The ombuds supposedly did an investigation. However, they will not release any of the records. They've just said there's no wrongdoing, which we just feel is kind of a cop-out. So we would like an independent investigation by some sort of other firm that is not related to the state. You really can't have a state agency investigating a state agency. It makes no sense to us. So if you could sign and share, we would appreciate it. We also have beautiful pictures of these children and some great social media profile pics that you can add as well to show your support for Hazel and Oakley and children like Jose Fernandez and Carrion Franks and just other children who have just been failed by the system. And really, it's about sharing their names and their stories. And when there's a call to action, when we need you to jump on board and write a letter or make a phone call or share a news article, that's the type of support we need right now. Hopefully, when we do have some legislation, and Ashley is on it because she is there meeting and going to the meetings. Tates and I are not local to Washington, but Ashley is. We will have all that information for you. So we will keep everybody informed there. And then Ashley will be our driving force in person.
Love that.
So that is where you can find information on the internet.
And just to piggyback off that, I think really just bringing awareness. I mean, just bringing awareness, like she said, you know, there's so much stuff on social media. I post stuff on social media. I share their stuff on social media. Just really bringing awareness to, you know, that this continues to keep happening. Not only just, you know, with DCYF cases per se, but just anything, child abuse, sexual abuse, any of that, because it all revolves around the same thing. And, you know, I think that a lot of times, especially when it comes to DCYF and state, they want to just push these things under the rug because they don't want people to realize what's really happening. And so, you know, just really just bringing awareness. If you see that I'm doing a protest, I really, this summer, I'm actually going to talk to Tates and Shayna about it later. We were talking about doing an event, like kind of a bigger event. I did, last year, it was the end of the session and I did a protest and it was okay, but we only had like, what, 3 weeks, Tate, or 3 weeks? I want to say 3 weeks to like get it advertised, get it out there, all of that. This year I did one in March and there was a foster woman who also helped. Her name is Shannon. She also helped. And I mean, it was snowing. It was literally snowing outside. And we did this event. And one thing that she came up with actually that was a huge impact is we got 145 pairs of shoes or 150 pairs of shoes, like little kids' shoes, and put them out on tables and put them out on the bottom area just to kind of represent the 85 children that were murdered and then the other 60 children that were either seriously injured or were basically near fatalities. So that was a big impact. And we had about 7 different legislators actually come out in the snow, talk to us, you know, kind of share with us kind of what was going on up there in the Capitol and what kind of bills were kind of trying to be processed and stuff. And I was really surprised because, I mean, it was literally snowing and these legislators came out, made their appearance, you know, and just showed their support. It all comes back to like bringing awareness. Like one of them like took pictures with all of us and then she actually posted it on her Facebook, you know, and like just bringing awareness to what is actually going on. That's, I don't know any other way that they can help because I don't, you know, I don't get into like the donation process and like all of that. I don't know much about that, but just bringing awareness. And if you see something, repost it, advertise it. And that, yeah, that's what I feel. How they could
educate yourself on what's happening in your community and yes, be aware of the programs around you and the people that are trying to help. I think a lot of the times we focus on what needs help and sometimes we don't know how to look for the helpers in the situation. So making sure that we educate people on who the helpers are, where they can go, and resources they can get are a huge step. And that the everyday person, like you said, it takes sharing something. In 5 seconds, you can hit that button and you can make a massive difference. And I don't think people realize how much that share, that like, that retweet, like it really makes a huge difference because, again, that is a simple education step. That's a simple awareness step of what is needed and what needs to be done. And that, unfortunately, in our country, what takes movement and change is many voices band together because they don't seem to want to hear the individual entities that are yelling and shouting. And so we almost have to build this army and say, hey, we're here. We're not going to go away. We're going to just keep bothering you. Like, we got time. And not everybody has the ability to do that. So if you don't have the ability to be standing on the steps, and that can come down to your life, finances, everything like that, you don't have the ability to walk into the Capitol. You don't have the ability to take on these cases. Just hit that share button. I mean, the massive amount of difference you make by just doing that. And literally, I think five seconds is giving it, you know, an extended amount of time. It's just boom, you're done and you've helped. And so that is always a big thing for me. And I think people look at this and they go, oh my gosh, there's so many problems and there's so many things I want to do. And they feel exasperated by the weight of this. I mean, these are children's lives and the weight of what they can do to change, but you can, we can take all that weight off you. Just hit share. I want to thank you, ladies, so much for joining me and coming to have a conversation that's never an easy one. And for all the work that you ladies have done to help these families and these children, because I think people lose the message. Like, it's not just about the children. It's absolutely about the children, but it is about families. It's not that we're against reunification. It's not against that we're against all these things. We want the child in whatever situation is the safest and the best. And I know as a kid that if I knew that there were ladies like us out there, it would have made all the difference. So from the little me to the big me, thank you, ladies, for the work that you do. It's very appreciated.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. I know that was a heavy one, and I know it was a long one. So thank you, especially if you made it through both parts. And please make sure you go follow the Light the Way Foundation. I will have all of their social media tagged in the video below and also on my website at sippingonsomecrime.com. I encourage you to go follow Ashley and her amazing journey. And congratulations once again, Ashley, for not only graduating, but seeing your dream and making it come true. And as always, don't forget, every time you see a missing or murdered post on social media, hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.